Mr. Whitaker, Reel 25. We were talking about your job as a lumberjack, and we hadn't actually got the name of the camp or the hut that you were at.
Its number was 208 Arbeits Commando 208L. It was attached to Stag 18A, and the place we were in was called Kleintau, which simply means little valley. There were two stones. There was another stone house about 100 yards down the valley. Our hut, and there was a quarry just above our camp where Yugoslavs, the chap from opposite, the Yugoslav worker from opposite, when I say forced labour, people who brought in worked at this quarry. There was also a blacksmith there who looked after our axes, and the carpenter used to repair axe handles, and this tool, the saw, and other repairs.
Now, you've told us the daily routine. How did the routine change within the week? Would you go 7 days a week, or...?
Saturday morning, you'd work 5.5 days, Saturday mornings, and Saturday afternoon, your first job, Saturday afternoon, was cutting wood for the Frau, as we called her, across the way. We took it in turns, upstairs 1 week, downstairs the next, and we'd chop her enough wood for the week, and then you chopped your own wood. And what you'd do, you'd usually arrange it between you that half of you downstairs had chopped for the lady, the old lady, and the other half had chopped wood for your own stove. We kept the piles separate, and you were on a bound not to pinch one another's, which we didn't. You know, there were only, I say, there were by about 15 of you. People came and went. And the routine followed the seasons. For instance, we'd cut this timber.
What about Sunday? Sorry.
Sundays you were off. You did your washing and catching up. And holidays. When I say holidays, the first day I can remember was my birthday, October the 15th, that would be 1943. We'd been there just a few days, and it snowed. By the time we came home from work, we were pretty well up to the knees. It was like that all that winter. The seasonal routine, we'd finished cutting. Franz, the boss, Nuna Franz, he measured the logs. They tried to get 6 metres out of the first, you'd get a log measuring 6 metres long, and then the top of the wood went for what we call Schleifholz. Paper went for pulping. But the idea they wanted was to get as big logs as possible, as many. Once they'd been cut into logs and trimmed, next thing in the winter they'd what we call shoot it, which was sending walloping down the hillsides, which was highly dangerous and highly exciting. The log would be sitting there, and all you had to do, watching the rest of the team very carefully, put this tool, which had a slightly curved handle and a big metal blade with a little point, just a little point, then turn up, stick it under the log, give it a jerk, it would turn the log, and of course, with it being icy, as soon as you release the grip on the slot, down it would go. You can imagine a 6 metre log about a metre wide or more. They'd go down this hill, particularly this one, like thunderbolts. So you do that in the way, and then stack it. Now, stacking timber is quite an art, because you can't get all the big ends together. So you have to stack. To do this, you wore what they call eisens, which are crampons, just like the climbers wear. And you never went on timber without them.
Why not?
You ask it, well, because you'd slip, you'd fall in between. It was, that's what we were told, and it, to work on top of, when you were stacking logs, or even, of course, they were very useful on the icy ground.
And how high would you stack them? I can't quite
remember. They'd stack them sort of one way. You stack one, what you'd do, you'd put a stack first one way, then the other. Stack them maybe, depending on the area, but maybe half a dozen logs high, sorted into 6 metre, 5 metre, 4 metre and so on.
And where were they? They were in the valley.
They were down in the valley. You'd shoot all the way down the hillside, wherever the job was, and there were several other gangs, and they'd all shoot it. This first job we run involved building a wooden chute to take it round one thing onto the level plain, and that was quite good because we had a huge pile of logs and chucked them one by one onto this chute we'd built out of little timber, and then they chucked water over it, and of course it froze, and we shot the springtime, and you do that in winter.
So, and who would take them away?
Now
from
there,
the stacks,
the fellas from the other, there was a tractor came up every day, and there was a small gang loaded trailers that this tractor brought. And the tractor was driven by a man, an English prisoner from the camp below. The nearest village was called Eaglebark. There was a village below there, and I've completely forgotten its name, where friends Harry and Ben had been posted, and that was a farm camp. But the crafty thing was, the chap down there, who we did go and visit, in the chief man of the camp, Ben Lightbound, was very crafty. And he didn't object at all to having an unsupervised British prisoner driving this tractor, because we could then exchange messages and anything else that, you know, any news and things that was going. So they'd take it, incidentally found, to my, I was very pleased, because none of the timber we cut ever got taken out. The wood yard at this village was stacked so high with timber, it was unbelievable. The forest belonged before the war to Prince something or other of Liechtenstein. The whole area belonged to Liechtenstein. But they'd put in charge a man they called the Forest Master, who was another Nazi. We were told to watch out for him. Our foreman, who was over the civilian as well, we called the Fierceman, whatever that means.
So all of it just went down to Eaglebark, and then it stayed there.
And it stayed there. It was there when we passed it when we left. Somebody would make a fortune out of it, because it was all there cut for nothing, ready to be used. The only timber I ever saw that was used, they didn't allow us to cut it because it was going to be used to repair a bridge. And they brought some Russians up one day and they cut these special trees out, which apparently are work well in water. Now these Russians, they hadn't got, all they'd got was axes and saws, and they brought a tractor with a huge long trailer, because they took the whole trees out, and one of the Russians broke his leg. He slipped while they were loading these trees and it broke a leg. And that's how, you know, that's why it wore spikes, these eisens, all the time.
Now, so you were talking about the seasonal way of things. You'd put them down the hill and you stack them. What was the next seasonal job?
Spring, they got everybody, all the villagers, the local villagers, I said the village, the nearest village was miles away, but they got all the locals, women as well, and they planted hundreds of little fir trees. And our job, the men, we had to dig. They gave you a little tool with just like a hoe thing. And you dug a little hole, and the woman would follow up behind and plant these up these damn steep hills. That was springtime. The last spring I was there, I got into trouble. I was utterly fed up with this stupid walking up this rotten hill, bent, double scratching me up. And the Fierceman, who I got on quite well with, really, he was a bit of a, he always trying to make you work. You know, when you're sitting down, which you often were when he appeared, do you good to work, you're only young. This particular morning, he'd been at me all morning. Work harder. V-Tarker, they used to call me. But, you know, what are you doing, V-Tarker? Work harder. And just after lunch, everybody sat down and had the lunch, and there were loads of these, the same women and people. And I was getting a bit niggled at I was fairly short-tempered in my youth, but during prison camp I learned, you know, did you know good to get cross? Well, this chap really got me mad. And just before the start, he said, we spoke this time, Pigeon German, you know, said, now this afternoon, he said, VTOC is going to really work. He says, not going to scratch it out like an old hen. And I learned a word from Franz, my old boss. He told me this word, he goes, something like Holy Ghost, and he said, all you English, I said, all you have is fuck. He said, but our word, he said, if you really want, he says in Germany, if you really want, he said, but don't ever use it, don't say I told you. So I thought this chap was about right for a bit, so in front of all of them, I used this word to him. He lifted about 2 foot in the air, reached in his hip pocket, we always carried a little automatic, and said, I'll shoot you. So I told him to go ahead. You know, I said, he told I'd fired more guns than he had on. You know, I was really mad. So, but to my delight, he said, go home, I'm not allowing you to work any longer. So on a beautiful spring day, he sent me back to the camp on my own, which was a nice little stroll. And I remember the guard said, you know, I had to knock, the guard was, he was stretched out fast asleep, and I had to knock him up. And he said, what have you been doing? And I said, oh, you've got to lock me up. And he shut me up for the afternoon, where I had a happy afternoon reading for that. Anyway, that was...
Do you know what it means, Holy Ghost?
I haven't a clue. I don't know how you spell it. But it certainly had the... By Jove, it had an effect on him.
So that was spring, the planting.
Yeah, planting.
What
then
about
in
summer?
Then come the summer, you'd have another, as they call it, a job to cut out. Each gang had a job. The forest master would come up, and between them and this fierceness, they'd work out what they were going to cut out the next season.
And what do you mean by...
They'd mark the trees, you know, just take an axe and mark them.
And would you actually chop them down?
And we'd go and cut them down.
That's quite a skillful job, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Although I say so, I'd got used to cross cutting. I spent a lot of time.
What are the skills of cross cutting?
Well, you've got to keep it steady.
The saw.
The saw. And working on the hillside, the idea was you cut as much tree as possible, so that the top side was level with the ground. And what you'd do, you'd cut, and as you cut into the tree, you've got to wedge it behind because the saw would jump. None of you, you know, sit with a chainsaw now, it's laughable. One man. And if you wavered, you'd sometimes, I'd seen them where Franz cursed me up then down Dale. A larch tree is murder because the resin sticks. And you'd have to chuck water. But usually get a fairly flat cut. And I, Franz, we got on quite well together. And I'd learned some German in school, but I wasn't prepared. The accent baffled me completely. But you soon learned, as Franz said, he said, oh, I talk to you like you do to a baby. And he wasn't a bad chap. He'd strictly forbidden, he'd give us the daily paper. Slip it into your pocket, you know. And some of the Maoris, and then they'd learned a lot of German, but they couldn't read the paper because it was printed in this black print. You know, the print of German in a paper print, and the paper was printed in that. So I'd read it and they'd translate it. Anyway, so you'd cut the trees down. Some of you
did you use the axe at all in cutting trees, or just...
Yes, just to make a wedge in the other side where you fell it. You'd have to take it in turn.
And did you have to watch where you were felling it too?
Oh, yes, because the idea was to try and drop two trees across one another so there'd be a bit of height for when you were sawing. Say, the other people out of the gang, you'd usually have two lots of people sawing, and the others would just come and chop the branches off roughly, and they'd take the bark off.
And that's what you'd do all the summer?
All the summer.
And then you'd come back into this first job you had of strimming?
Yeah.
And
The other thing, when you take the bark off at night, you'd pile the bark, fold it into a big bundle and drive a red peg through it. And the daring ones amongst you, and the young stooping ones, you'd ride down, you'd get on one of these and urge it down the hill. And if the hill where you'd cut timber was gradually got quite sandy, you know, and it was quite, often is quite soft, and you'd roar down the hill astride or sitting on this until you hit a tree or so, got thrown off, it much quicker than going down the path.
And did you do that?
Oh, yes. You'd get to the bottom, and you'd get there again, you'd leave that on a level slope. They took that to a tannery, the bark.
How did you get the bark off?
With a, they had a thing called a schleife, and it's like a, something like a straight, a triangular tool on the end of a very long rod. You'd ring the tree with your axe, and then slide this thing underneath, and the bark would come off quite easily. But you'd go home at night, whether you were sawing or trimming, black, because the resin, the fir trees, it could stick to you. You've got lots of hot water and so.
Did you have trouble with your blisters and your hands and
oh
things?
Oh, yes, at first, yeah. I only cut myself once. I chopped a piece out. I went through my boot one day with my axe. Otherwise, I'd...
Well, there are many. I mean, it's you mentioned the Russian civilian broke his leg, like that. Were there many accidents?
We didn't have many, except for the disastrous ones which have come to. It's just the odd, the only nasty one. One of them, I was chopping wood one day and not looking what he was doing, managed to point his axe just against, almost cut this little bit of skin between his thumb and his fingers, which would have caused, if he'd gone right through, would have caused a real... He was bandaged for several weeks.
How did you get on with the other men? I mean, you changed partners with Jack Sykes, but you were still getting on well with Jack from the sound of things. How about with the Maoris and the Australians?
The Australians, one of them called the Maoris black men. He didn't like them at all. I found that the Australians, they've got complete contempt for the Aboriginals. And I also found, which distressed me somewhat, that Maoris in New Zealand were regarded as second-class citizens who weren't allowed in pubs. And there were various restrictions on them. Most of them, one was a pretty nasty piece of work.
An Australian or?
A Maori.
What was wrong with him?
Well, he was sly. It was all good, you know, but he... It told tales to the Germans, or Austrians, I should call them.
What about the others, though?
The others were pretty good. Marvellous instrumentalists. Beautiful. They played guitar better than anybody you've heard in your life, and I'm not exaggerating.
Where would they get the guitar from? I mean,
Red Cross had brought them. They had one spare one, and they taught me six chords, marked with chalk, and I used to join in. You could even have a wired guitar with a piece of glass from a bottle which they'd scrounge, slide it along. Lovely. Jack Sykes used to play the violin. They didn't fancy the violin. They weren't much good with the bow. They were quite good. But, for instance, they sent a ukulele up while I was there with the Red Cross, and I'd had a ukulele, and I tuned it. And within the same night, this chap that I didn't care for, this Maori, Harry Meyer, he was playing tunes on this ukulele, and nobody plays tunes on a ukulele. It was better than George Formby knew how to be, and he'd learned that in an evening. I'd never seen him before.
Did you feel, I mean, you said you were upset, you obviously didn't feel this prejudice about Maoris?
Not particularly, I was ever all right.
And what about the Australians?
Stan was from Sydney, and he called Herb a bush larrikin, because Herb came from what we call the irrigation country, where the town where he lived still had hitching rails. And Stan also didn't like, although they were partners, you know, they mucked in with parcels, but Stan thought Herb was the last, he wasn't a real man, because Herb went to dancers to dance. And in Australia, I understood all you went to dance for was because you were allowed booze after 6 o'clock. So they had a sort of uneasy sort of relationship because they were only Australians, weren't they? But as I say, the season's passed on. Summer was grand. You could, the guards, they came and went.
Did you get on well with them or as a whole?
One or two were. They varied. We had one who'd come from France and who vowed he'd been having it off with a mother and daughter in France. When he came in, he said, "Call me Monsieur Joseph," which he said, "You don't give me any trouble, I won't give you any." But this time we'd had two guards. We usually had one chap from the folks room, sort of Dad's army. But they varied. Most of them, provided you kept him, you know, didn't give them any trouble.
Did any of the prisoners try and get away for a bit of activity with any of the local women or get into the, you know?
I'll tell you a funny thing about that. Well, I thought it was funny. One Saturday, I scrambled out and gone to work because I'd had some boots mended. There was a cobbler down the road who, apart from cobbling shoes, used to eat cats, which made the place stink horrible. And just against there was another cottage where a woman lived whose old man had been called up. Went down this Saturday morning, scrounging out of work, got to get my boots. I went down and went and got my boots. Then I don't know who paid for them. I thought, oh, yeah, I cut it. And as I was coming out, who came out of this woman's foot but Standiva, the Australian. And I was absolutely staggered. And I said, you crafty old soul. I said, what about all these? I said, all these other. There weren't many girls. Okay, they'd take you down to the pub on a Sunday afternoon if one of the guards felt like it. You weren't allowed to talk to civilians, but you know, some of the local girls would come along, had no somewhere, and then you'd pass a few. But Stan, walking back, told me, I said, you've got to, he said, you've got to get your priorities right in this one. He says, choose one of them. She'll be bringing to all the mates. And he said, I should be in the cooler. He said, all shot quicker. He said, get her who's older. He says, she's been married years, an old man away. He says, she won't say a word. I was never so surprised in my life. As I say, that's the wild strawberries up the hill. Blueberries, blackberries.
Did you ever think, I mean, none of the work you did was of any use to the Germans, apparently, since they never seemed to get any of the wood. But, I mean, did you ever consider any sort of sabotage or, you know, work sabotage or disruption?
Not particularly. By that time, we decided to settle for the quiet life. Of course, it all changed during that year because the Americans started to come over. Which was absolutely, now that was something that, when I think back now, I think nobody will ever see that again. Up the hill one day, working on the job, and there came 20 or 30 Boeings came over Graz, which was about, I suppose, 30, 40 kilometres away. But we heard, you could hear the flag. And of course this attracted attention. These fortresses circled and we saw the smoke rising. That was the first one. Then sometime after that, they started to come over in daytime quite regularly. Masses and masses of them. Big boxes, just sometimes as far as you could see, airplanes. I've seen them on a bright sunlight day, and when they'd finished, if they were trailing, as we call it, you know, contrailed, it would be clouded anyway. The civilians loved it as much as we did at first. It was a magnificent sight. It really was, you know, seeing these things sailing over, it really was. I got a bit mixed up, though, because amongst them, sometimes some would come fairly low. And there were these big things with twin tails, which I didn't know. And I thought these were Lancasters. Turned out later they were B-24s. But it was a magnificent sight. What really broke it, though, was came over one day and we heard the bombing, and it was a big raid, and we heard the bombing, and the civilian was all said, oh, it's so-and-so, a village we didn't know. And then I think it sunk home then, these people weren't just up there looking pretty, that they were actually blasting hell out of somewhere. We passed this place later and they bombed a small ammunition factory. Well, as they bombed it, they busted it out of existence, complete with most of the houses in the, well, not, they'd damaged every house in the village, little town. But the alarming thing was, they're usually going to be in the Neustadt, where we understood there was a lot of industry. But the stragglers, they didn't come back our way, but the stragglers and the wounded did. And some of these things had come over flying sideways, you know, three engines, two and a bit, sometimes sound it all there. We all just look at that and say, please keep going now. And we saw one come down, one came over one day, two engines on fire, flames, piles of smoke, and as he got right over, the third engine went, poof, and the doors came off, and out came, we saw seven men come out, we think the others got out later, and they locked us up straight away. It was a Sunday, and they locked us up, and now, sometime after, Fierschner came back with his sporting rifle, and this young American marching for, so he gave him a big cheer, and he just, you know, and they took him into this house opposite. The Germans, all the Austrian papers of the Germans, they always referred to them as Luftgangsters, air gangsters, and these two ladies never got over it. They said, oh, good looking boy, just like our lads. A tall, fair haired, you know, what a good looking lad, big, tall, you know, 6 foot tall. And they never forgot this young man. It had completely destroyed everything that had ever been told about the Americans. They took him down, and that was the last thing we saw of him.